I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to our Year in Review series, as today we focus on the management of lung cancer and mesothelioma, and specifically non-targeted therapy, and we'll deal with targeted therapy in another part of this series. We have an outstanding faculty today, Dr. Matt Gubins and Dr. Suresh Ramalingam, who are here to talk about a really important area, one that we saw a lot of developments in this past year, like the last 5 years, particularly related to immunotherapy. Here's where we're heading today. We're going to start out talking about non-small cell lung cancer, mainly metastatic disease. Then we'll talk about mesothelioma and then small cell. Before we get started, just want to take a breath before we start roaring through all the literature and just talk a little bit about immunotherapy and where it is, you know, kind of beyond some of the clinical trials. And Suresh, you know, I spent about an hour and a half last week with Dr. Solange Peters talking about predictors of benefit to immunotherapy. And I thought my head was going to explode after we finished TMB, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm curious, you know, I'm starting to hear about some new ways to predict benefit for immunotherapy. There was a really interesting paper, actually Dr. Neil was involved with a direct on durable immunotherapy response estimation using pretreatment, circulating DNA, as well as CD8 T cell levels. Suresh, we've talked about, you know, radiomimetics to try to evaluate response. It's been really kind of frustrating since checkpoint inhibitors came out, Suresh, to try to figure out who benefits. Anything new and exciting that you think might have some future?
Thanks, Neil. Thanks for having me in the program. I think PD-L1 expression in the tumor today remains the current standard to select therapy. But clearly, we know that there are patients with low PD-L1 who derive benefit, and even patients with high PD-L1 who don't derive durable benefits. So the search for biomarkers for these patient populations remains. I think looking at CD8 T cells, looking at the tumor microenvironment, whether it's a cold or a hot microenvironment, using imaging characteristics to see if the tumor is rich in T cells, functional imaging probes that tag the CD8 T cells are all already in clinic, and these are going through investigations. So our hope is as we learn more about how to apply these and correlate them in large clinical data sets, we may be able to use them on top of PD-L1. I don't see them replacing PD-L1 in the near future, but adding something else to PD-L1 expression levels to determine the best treatment forward would be exciting and valuable for our patients.
So Matt, again, anything new in immunotherapy? You know, we have the bread and butter trials that really define what our clinical approach is. Also curious where you think things might be heading in terms of adjuvant and neoadjuvant trials, Matt. We're starting to see this in other tumor types, whether, you know, in sometime in the next year, ASCO, et cetera, maybe we're going to start to see some data on that.
Yeah, again, thanks for having me, Neil. This is definitely an exciting area that's emerging. There's some really provocative data about pathologic response after even just one or two doses of a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor. And so there are phase 2 registrational trials with a variety of strategies, whether it be pure adjuvant immunotherapy or incorporating some neoadjuvant immunotherapy with or without chemo. And I think these will really be interesting to see. We are going to see them probably read out in the next year or two, maybe not this ASCO, but coming soon. And I think it lends itself to this conversation, because what happens if people do get that adjuvant or neoadjuvant therapy and then have relapse? Can we treat the data we're about to talk about for treatment-naive patients? Can we really look at it the same way? How will we understand these patients who are, in a sense, are immunorefractory or immunoresistant a year or longer on?
Yeah, in our ASCO GI series, we're going to talk about adjuvant Nevo for gastroesophageal cancer. This is like here now. Real quick, I just want to go to the interesting question. The question is, after concurrent chemo RT for stage 3, do you prefer PET scan or CT chest? And how about if there's a new nodule in the lung after chemo RT on PET prior to initiation of DERVA? So Ram, how do you think through imaging in this situation and treatment for that matter?
Sure. So our go-to approach is the CT scan after a few weeks after patients have completed chemo RT. If one is doing a PET, it's critical that you don't do it too soon, because inflammation will trigger FDG uptake and you'll be left with a confusing picture. In terms of new nodule, it really boils down to how big the nodule is, what are the characteristics of the nodule. Sometimes what happens is these new nodules are totally unrelated to the cancer. They are inflammatory in origin. Or it could be that these are true progressions that are happening. This could have been present at a smaller size, not enough for visualization at the baseline. And as the treatments have proceeded, they could have grown. So I would like to spend some time learning a little more about the nodule with my radiologist. And sometimes if needed to be biopsied, we can biopsy that to see whether that is true progression, in which case our treatment would move in a slightly different direction.
And Matt, I see you commented in the chat room, I guess, about the idea considering what are you thinking, maybe oligomet type of approach with radiating the nodule if there's nothing else?
With all the caveats that Suresh mentioned, we'd certainly want to know more about the nodule and kind of work it up a bit. It's all about context. But if there really does what feels like an oligo progression, we would probably be inclined to at least try radiating that spot and maybe proceeding with consolidation durva. But kind of, again, depends on the situation.
So one more question again until we dive into the clinical decision making. And that is about the issue of secondary checkpoint. Suresh, we've heard about TIM-3, LAG-3, and it seems like none of that has really played out very well. But we did see some maybe early data of the so-called anti-TIGIT approach. Suresh, curious what your thoughts are about trying to, you know, obviously the ipi-nivo anti-CTLA-4 PD-L1 combination has, very interesting. But what about these other checkpoint blockers, Suresh? Where do you think that's heading?
There's a lot of interest in targeting co-stimulatory or co-inhibitory molecules in order to expand on the benefits of PD-1 inhibition or PD-L1 inhibition. And they are in various stages of development. In lung cancer, at least what's interesting that we saw at ASCO in 2020 was the combination of targeting TIGIT and targeting PD-L1. This was a randomized phase 2 trial in the frontline setting, atezolizumab plus or minus the TIGIT antibody. And this trial showed that in the PD-L1 high expressing patients, greater than 50%, the combination of TIGIT plus PD-L1 was better than using atezolizumab alone. In the low PD-L1s, there was no added value of TIGIT plus PD-L1 inhibition. So this has now led to a phase 3 trial in this patient population that's currently ongoing. This is potentially interesting, showing benefit with the combination. But one of the things that still needs a little more context is the fact that the median PFS for the combination of TIGIT plus PD-L1 was about 7+ months in this study, which is not very different if you look at the PD-L1 monotherapy data in the high PD-L1 expressing patients. So how much value the TIGIT adds, the phase 3 trial will tell us, but certainly interesting results worthy of further pursuit.
So here's where we're heading in terms of talking about the real practical issue of first-line therapy. I can remember the first approval in lung cancer, I think it was only like 5 years ago, you know, and now we have this blizzard of phase 3 clinical trials we can take a look at these. And I should mention that I spent an hour with each one with Matt and Ram recording their presentation. We're posting both presentations. We go through all these trials in detail, cases, et cetera, along with this roundtable discussion as an integrated CME program. But just amazing, all the trials that have come out in these past 5 years, and now looking at, you know, only like 9 approved strategies. So we're going to take a shot at doing, you know, what we've been doing the last couple of years, which is trying to sort it out, particularly trying to sort it out in a practical way that'll be useful for people in practice. And, you know, there are different ways to cut it. You can think about the type of patient, the age, et cetera. But I think maybe the best way to approach this is by focusing primarily on PD-L1 level. So what we're going to try to do in the next few minutes is first go through the trials. So I mean, kind of starting with some of the combination approaches. And Matt, we saw this at the ASCO meeting. Very interesting idea, adding on 2 cycles of chemo to ipi-nivo, the CheckMate 9LA study. Anything you want to say about that study, Matt? And what situations, if any, you think about this strategy?
It's definitely kind of a quadrifecta or a kitchen sink approach, right? The idea that when we use immunotherapy, there are some patients who will in early on fail. And so the idea here is get the chemo on board to try to get an early response and give time for the strong, in this case, double immunotherapy approach to work. And so what they add are 2 cycles of appropriate platinum doublet chemotherapy, and then continue Nevo Ipi as you would with CheckMate 227. And what they saw was a very clear benefit in terms of overall survival. I guess one point I would make is that the hazard ratio really wasn't that much better than nivo-ipi alone versus chemo. So, you know, it didn't kind of blow it out of the water for having that upfront strong approach. So I think the kind of patient I'd be thinking about is if I'm already inclined to use nivo-ipi, but I have a patient with high burden of disease, clearly a quick tempo of progression, I'm very symptomatic, that might be the patient where I really do throw the kitchen sink, get my response, and then back off, knowing that I can maybe bring back chemo to future line of therapy if needed.
And Suresh, you know, you hear the same thinking about patients and with high PD-L1 levels in terms of whether or not to add chemo to a checkpoint inhibitor. You hear people saying, well, if the patient's got a lot of symptoms, I'm really nervous they're going to deteriorate in the next few months, I'd be more likely to add in chemo, even if they're PD-L1 high. Is the same kind of thinking here with the SLA strategy?
That is what I have taken home from the CheckMate 9LA trial, which is that when you look at 2-7 where EP and Nevo were given, there was an initial crossover of the curves, ipi-nivo versus chemo. And then once you got into the second or third half of the follow-up, ipi-nivo clearly stood up superior to chemo. When you give a look at the 9LA curves, there was a clear separation early on, and that was maintained as the follow-up continued. And what this tells us is that if there are patients who are at high risk for developing adverse consequences early on, and those we tend to relate with patients whose performance status is declining fast, patients whose disease burden and metastatic burden is so high, that those are the patients where giving that 2 cycles of chemo may help bridge that part of their treatment course. So that's the approach I have taken, just like what Matt mentioned.
So, Matt, of course, the other major trial, the KEYNOTE 189 trial, it really has become an integral part of practice with for the non-squamous tumors, pembro-pem and platinum, and you know now often used, particularly with lower PD-L1 levels. Anything you want to say about these data and you know kind of follow-up data that we've seen along the way from this trial, Matt?
I guess really confirmatory of what we saw with its original presentation. It's interesting to see these data mature over literally years now. And we really see that persistent benefit at all PD-L1 levels, 0%, 1-49, 50+%. They did a little bit of more subgroup analysis in this group, looking at liver metastasis, whether that affected benefit. And they did show there was kind of persistent benefit. So that was kind of an interesting finding, but not unexpected.
So I'm going to take a couple quick cases from the chat room. Ram, 63-year-old patient, T3N3, pericardial effusion, cytology negative from the effusion. This is a squamous cell. What would you treat this patient with? Stage 4, but sounds like it'd be stage 4. How would you manage a patient like that, Suresh?
So the pericardial effusion and the pericardial involvement is something that needs to be looked into further. Cytology can be negative in half the patients in the first shot. So I would look at the PET scan. I would make sure I evaluate the echo carefully. We want the patient to get the benefit of doubt of this being a lower stage disease. If I can convince myself that the pericardial effusion is non-malignant and just more of a reactive phenomenon, I would still be inclined to treat with chemo-RT targeting the nodal disease in the primary tumor.
Interesting. So Matt, here's another case from the chat room. A 63-year-old woman, stage 3A squamous cell, the left lung, status post-concurrent chemo radiation, carbo-paclitaxel, start on consolidation durvalumab, and then progressed. The patient gets stereotactic radiation to the left lung, gets some radiation pneumonitis, steroid taper, nothing actionable on NGS. How do you approach these patients who progressed on consolidation durvalumab, Matt? I imagine that's not rare.
And it's going to become more common as we go. That's hard. She had presumably a full year of durvalumab. I don't know how soon this progression happened, though, given how recent the data are, it must have been fairly soon after. I think the extra wrinkle in this case is how do we think of immunotherapy re-challenges in the setting of prior radiation pneumonitis. And I think that's a little harder to suss out than pure immunotherapy pneumonitis. In that case, I expect a recidivism rate of about 50% or upwards of that. In this case, where there was a clear radiation pneumonitis, maybe clear by the field of radiation being the area, it would really depend on if the steroids were off, if there's been some time since the steroid taper. If she really is still on the steroid taper, I probably would go to chemotherapy alone, at least for the short term, and then consider re-adding immunotherapy, with cycle 3 or in the next line of therapy. if she was well past her steroid taper and this is a later progression, I would at least think about cautiously doing a chemo IO approach.
So just out of curiosity, Matt, when you said chemotherapy, which chemo and what about ramucirumab?
This is a squamous cell patient, I believe. Mm-hmm. I know she got weekly carbopaclitaxel with her initial chemo XRT. I would consider still doing kind of a carbotaxane pembrolizumab. That's probably my first approach there. You could think about ipi/nivo. I might be a little more disinclined, especially if that steroid taper is still on board or recently completed.
So Suresh, any comments about this? And you know, very common question in general in oncology, patients who progress on monotherapy with a checkpoint inhibitor using something like ipi/nivo, not necessarily next, but somewhere along the line. Any comments?
I think Matt's approach of if a patient has not seen full systemic doses of chemotherapy and now has progressed after immunotherapy, starting with chemo plus an IO approach is very reasonable. You know, if there is no steroid, no autoimmune adverse events with prior immunotherapy, I think I would go with chemo plus ipi/nivo in that situation.
And maybe what the requesting physician's kind of asking is, do we rechallenge if you're kind of describing failure? But I think, you know, either Suresh's approach to do nivo ipi or doing a chemo IO, the hope is to re-energize the benefit of immunotherapy in a different context. So I don't shy away from it, again, assuming it's a safe way to proceed pneumonitis-wise.
Yeah, and actually the doc says the patient's off steroids now, so that's great. So getting back to the data, Ram, in terms of monotherapy, we have two options in terms of atezo and pembro. Any comments on where we are with the data with these approaches, what we've learned over the last couple of years?
Well, what we learned is these are highly effective drugs for patients with PD-L1 greater than 50. Atezo and pembro are both approved. Cemiplimab is another drug that has shown similar data in a large phase 3 trial. It's not approved yet. But what we can say is from these trials, response rates are in the order of 45 to 50%. We now know from the KEYNOTE 025-024 study that 5-year survival for these patients with pembro is close to 32%. The question that was asked is, does this mean these patients are cured from the cancer? Well, we hope it is the case. We still need to see how these patients' course progresses. But to me, these are exciting results. It firms up the position of IO alone for the high PD-L1 patients. Is there a difference between pembro and atezo? I don't think the efficacy results suggest a big difference between the two drugs.
So I always use this statistic, the 32% 5-year survival metastatic lung cancer, to throw up to the other tumor types and say, hey, you know, can you do this as well? Matt, any thoughts?
I think you have the slide up on this. I think one of the interesting points on this trial as they do this kind of long-term follow-up, we get the benefit of more time, but we also learn about some of the unique aspects of this trial. Remember, pembrolizumab on this trial is not forever. It's 2 years and done, but there was an opportunity for retreatment if there's progression after a discontinuing. And so this is the first time we see some data in this first line single agent setting that show that, here's the slide exactly. So, you know, it's 12 patients in a big randomized phase 3, but at least to hint that in these patients who had a good benefit, finished 2 years, recurred at some point after the 2 years, you could get a response again by rechallenging with pembro in at least a number of these patients. Not all of them, there was a progressor here, but I think this is what we're going to see more of as these trials mature and we can learn more about duration and rechallenge as an entity too.
And Ram, how are you approaching the issue of discontinuation of therapy? Do you stop it at 2 years? Does it depend on how the patient's responding? How do you make that decision outside a trial right now?
If we don't see any disease on the CAT scans at the end of 2 years of therapy, we've approached this discussion with the patient about saying, hey, we don't have any additional evidence. You've done well. We don't see anything on the CT scan. We recommend that we stop the treatment and follow the scans closely. And most patients are comfortable with that plan. And we do provide reassurance with the data that just Matt showed. If there were to be a growth in the cancer, we can re-challenge you with pembro. Especially during the COVID pandemic, where patients are trying to minimize trips to the hospital, this is yet another reason to keep them safe after 2 years by not continuing on with the infusion.
So, we also mentioned cemiplimab as another PD-1 inhibitor. Great data. I don't know if it's ever going to get approved since it's kind of late to the game, although it is approved in squamous cell. We just heard some great stories about responses, incidentally, in squamous cell of the skin. But again, it kind of looks like the other agents in terms of efficacy. I guess, Matt, you know, kind of also leads into the question is, are all PD-L1 agents created the same? Is PD-L1 versus PD-1 the same? I've heard people say maybe the PD-1's a little bit better, more toxicity. Any way right now, Matt, to distinguish various checkpoint inhibitors or types of checkpoint inhibitors?
I think with the high-level data we have at this point, there's really nothing to recommend a PD-1 or a PD-L1 in particular. Certainly, I think there are some at least thoughts about whether partnering them with future co-stimulatory or co-inhibitory checkpoints or other immunotherapy markers may yield more or less benefit. But at least in the data we have, there's not convincing efficacy or toxicity differences, I'd say.
Any thoughts about that, Suresh? Again, I have heard people talk about the fact that maybe there are going to be differences that are going to show up with time. Any thoughts?
From a clinical standpoint, I agree with Matt. We've not seen any differences. There are distinct differences between one antibody versus the other, but that has not translated into major differences in effectiveness in lung cancer.
So, of course, a lot of times, even though we think these agents are more alike than different, we have to kind of go with the data. And I always use the example of Durva consolidation as, if you have the data, there people are going to use it. We don't have the data with other checkpoint inhibitors, so we're using Durva. Matt, we did see some updated data this year. It looks kind of encouraging with more follow-up. Any comments on this? And are you starting to think that maybe we're going to improve the cure rate?
That's what it's looking like. These curves do stay splayed. And obviously 5 years is the target we're looking for to have a little better sense of cure, but it's reassuring to see these curves stay apart. There wasn't that much more in the forest plots. There's kind of an ongoing discussion about the role of PD-L1 in this setting. But keep in mind, PD-L1 is checked before the initiation of chemo radiation. And part of the point is the chemo radiation changes the milieu such that maybe that initial PD-L1 is less important than what's going on post-radiation. So, as you know, in Europe, PD-L1 less than 1%, durvalumab is not approved. It is approved in the U.S. I tend to use it in those patients. I don't know what Suresh does, but I tend to still use it. I talk about these data, but I feel that there's enough wiggle room around kind of the uncertainty of this particular PD-L1 marker that really has a 25% cut point, maybe not as refined at the low range, that I do offer it to these folks in this curative setting where I really do want to at least try for that advantage when there's a point estimate favoring it, even if it's kind of wide whiskers around it.
And I see someone in the chat room asked about when you have to start it. And Suresh says, if possible, within 4 weeks. And vis-a-vis our discussion about are all PD-1 the same, brings up the fact that Pembro worked as a single agent and Nevo didn't. Although I guess most people think it was the way the trial was done, Ram.
I would say so. There are differences in trial to trial and from patient population to the other. The directionality of these trials are not much different. You get into the numbers, there is a difference. So I would say if you look at second line trials that compared Nevo versus docetaxel, Pembro versus docetaxel, Atezo versus docetaxel, the results are identical.
Well, let's just try to fly through the basic ABCs of PD-L1 level and what you do. Of course, we'll get into, you have brain mets, you have an old patient, comorbidities, et cetera, but kind of your general approach to these situations. So audience, in general, how are you thinking through the patient with metastatic disease, TPS of 0? So it'll be real interesting to see. One thing, Suresh, you've been presenting the incredible data on Ipi-Nevo. And I know in our discussions, the audience is almost completely going with carbo-pem, pembro. A few people saying ipi and nevo plus chemotherapy. So let's start out. Well, actually, let's start out with Matt, because I know you're going to give the answer more like the audience. We'll see what Suresh says. But so Matt, PD-1 is 0. What are you thinking?
I'm not just pandering to the audience. We still tend to be a carboplatin, pemetrexed, pembrolizumab shop for the vast majority of our patients, 0 to at least 49%. I know that the data were provocative for Nevo-Ipi, and I'll be curious to see how Suresh kind of discusses his clinic's approach. But I still use carbo-pembro, which has a clear survival benefit over chemo alone, even for those 0% patients.
And we know that, you know, we're always asking investigators what they do, you know, outside of trial. We know most people give that answer, but I was so happy that we can get the two of you together because, Suresh, I know you have a different point of view.
Yes, Neil. I think PD-L1 negative patients, the treatment paradigm first was to give chemo plus immunotherapy, and that is a practice pattern that is well entrenched in various settings. The Ipi-Nivo data are relatively recent, and what we showed at ASCO was the durability of responses, the three-year survival rate in PD-L1 negative patients was 34% with the Ipi-Nivo approach. And to me, that's the part that drives me towards that direction for a PD-L1 negative patient. Now, we saw the same results even with PD-L1 positive patients, but we know chemo immunotherapy works really well even for the PD-L1 positive patients. So for the very low PD-L1 patients or the negative ones, I have started thinking and discussing with patients about the Ipi-Nivo combination.
And, you know, Matt, that idea of the responses being longer kind of makes sense because they're all getting immunotherapy, whereas if you give chemo IO, some of the responses are going to be chemo, maybe shorter term. Any thoughts about this? It's ironic that that's the one subset that's not approved by the FDA, so you have to kind of get around that. Any thoughts about that answer, Matt? And I know even PD-L1 low, Suresh thinks about it also.
Certainly, and it's totally plausible. I do admit it, in my market, I worry more because even though it's on NCCN, it's a regimen that we've had a little more trouble getting approval for. So I buy the reasoning. We happen not to employ that reasoning quite yet.
So let's go to the PD-1 positive. I think there's even more debate there. Audience, how do you think through a patient who's got a TPS of 50%? We're going to say 65-year-old patient. We'll say, you know, the patient's not super sick in this situation. Maybe you'd give a different answer if the patient was 79 with a lot of comorbidities. But what would you do with a 50%? And actually, interestingly, I think I'm reading here that, well, first of all, there's a bunch of different answers. The most common one, actually, Ram, is PD-1 alone, by far the most common answer at 50%, even though we presented a younger, you know, patient who's not in, you know, any dire situation. Any thoughts about that, Suresh? And how do you look at the clinical history and then, you know, age, comorbidities, brain mets? How does that all figure in what you do in a high TPS situation, Suresh?
Sure. So when somebody has a PD-L1 expression level of 50 or higher, I think we have very nice data for monotherapy. Pembro alone, atezo alone as very effective in the setting. And we talked about the five-year survival rate. So for those patients, I think starting with single agent therapy is very reasonable for most instances. Now, you mentioned in this patient's case, Neil, the patient is not super symptomatic, and therefore there is no temptation to consider throwing in chemo on top of PD-1 inhibition. But there are situations where patient's clinical situation is somewhat dire and you want to give them everything in your arsenal. So there we would give chemo plus PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibition.
So I want to ask Matt about this, but first I want to throw out another poll question to the audience. So when we said the PD-L1 was 50%, 58% of you said PD-L1 alone. Let me see if I see any atezo. Yeah, no. What about if TPS is 95%? Does that make a difference or are you still going to do the same thing? So Matt, how do you approach a 50%? Actually, it looks like the audience whipped right into antibody alone, almost 90%. So to the audience, it made a difference. How about to you, Matt?
It certainly does. And I did say that for the 50% case, I put carbo-pembro, partly to be a little provocative, but also just to have an excuse to mention that one of the nice pieces of some of these studies has been to do subgroup analyses of the level of PD-L1 expression. And there actually is kind of a gradient that a PD-L1 50% patient is different than a PD-L1 95% patient. The response rates are higher, the duration of responses are longer. So with all that said, I tend to give single agent when I can, but I do admit at a 50%, the bigger burden diseases, even if not that symptomatic yet, are still going to at least make me think about carbo-pembro.
So, you know, we like to do a little edutainment and have some fun. And Suresh, would you like to give us your thoughts about? Because I know in our conversation, you say 50, 95 is the same.
for practical purposes, I agree. 50 and 95 is the same. Maybe in California, they'd look at it differently. but I think a high PD-L1 expressing tumor is something that we are comfortable giving monotherapy. Remember, the tumor heterogeneity is a driving factor. You may look at one part of the tumor and get excited about PD-L1. Another part of the tumor may not have it. And what we get is a single snapshot of what's happening in the tumor. So I'm good with any end of that greater than 50% spectrum to drive my treatment.
So as long as we're talking about clinical issues and taking care of patients, Matt, any thoughts about Q6 weeks Pembro? Do you use it in everybody from the start? Do you wait a while? Do you not use it? What do you think?
Practically, my approach is to still do it Q3 weeks, at least initially. Even if the response rate is 50%, that means half the patients are progressing. I'd rather have clinical sense of how patients are doing a little faster. That's my gut feeling. I don't think there's a problem with going to 6 weeks, but my actual operationalization of it is really to do a Q3 weeks, at least through the first or second imaging, and then to broach the idea of broadening it to Q6 weeks.
So it's interesting, Suresh. You know, I kind of feel in, you know, sort of just, you know, generally that the lung people have been slower to go jump on Q6 weeks than a lot of the other tumors. I kind of think it's like you don't want to rock the boat because you've come from a bad, bad place and you're starting to really see some cool stuff. You just don't want to do anything different. I also have heard people say they're not sure whether you get sort of a generalized immune reaction activation and maybe patients feel like a little bit like having the flu or whatever, that's worth with a higher dose. Any thoughts about Q6 weeks, Suresh?
I think it's a very reasonable approach to pursue. We are set in our practice patterns and it takes a little longer for us to change. So if I'm starting somebody on monotherapy with Pembro these days, I'm comfortable going to Q6. If I'm doing Pembro with chemo, I still stay with the Q3 because they're going to come anyway every 3 weeks. Right. And then when I get into the maintenance part of it, I can switch to Q6 weeks. So that's been the approach I'm following now. All the insurance companies are on board. Initially, we had some variation in who approved it and who did not. But we passed that point to say monotherapy Q6 is perfectly reasonable.
I will admit, I was very happy to jump on the durvalumab Q4 week approval. Especially these are patients we've beaten up with chemo radiation. It's nice to kind of let them stay out of our clinic when they can. So that we've embraced quite quickly.
Right. So I want to give a question to the audience also. We were talking about consolidation durvalumab. Of course, we had this super exciting presentation, the ADAURA data at ASCO, and then the publication of the paper in December, and really got people thinking about we're using metastatic disease, we're using adjuvant. What about stage 3 in between? What are we going to do about them? And so we're asking the audience here in general, how are you approaching a patient who's got an EGFR mutation? And there's a consensus, just kidding, they're completely split. I actually think there are 4 answers the audience is giving, but mostly it's either Durva or OC. And other people say both. There's some people say combined. Others say Durva followed by OC. Pretty creative audience here, Ram. How do you approach the... A lot of investigators go, I'm sticking with the survival data and doing Durva. But how about you, Suresh?
So 2 wrong answers. Durva plus OC is not something you want to combine. There is toxicity. And the same reason Durva followed by OC also has toxicity because half-life of Durva is fairly long. There is an ongoing trial called LAURA, which randomizes patients to OC versus none in the post-chemo RT setting. And ideally, if we had a patient, we want to get them on this particular trial. And hopefully, we'll get the definitive answer. I'm sticking to using Durva in these patients. It's hard to beat a 4-year or 5-year survival rate of 48% and a median survival of 4 years in the post-chemo RT setting for Durva. We did see benefit even with EGFR mutated patients in terms of PFS in this patient population. So that's my go-to approach at this time. And I would love to move to OC as soon as the LAURA results are available.
So let's move on now, talk about malignant pleural mesothelioma. And not too much to talk about in the past, but now things are heating up a little bit. And we've done programs now just on mesothelioma for an hour and a half. So there's a lot to talk about now. We're going to talk about, of course, the big Ipi-Nivo study there, but also we're going to talk about tumor treating fields as an adjunct to chemotherapy in the first-line setting and new approaches to this interesting modality. But just to begin, Suresh, can you talk about the data that was presented just this past year on Ipi-Nivo as first-line therapy?
Sure. This is a phase 3 trial that was reported about 5 months ago. This was a direct comparison of AP plus Nivo to platinum pemetrexed chemotherapy in the frontline meso setting. And the trial was positive. It has 600 patients. It showed improvement in overall survival. You see here 14 versus 18 months with a respectable hazard ratio of 0.74. What was also interesting is they look at sarcomatoid versus epithelioid mesothelioma. And the hazard ratio was very compelling in the non-epithelioid or the sarcomatoid variants. And that was primarily driven by the fact that chemo didn't do quite so well in that patient population, which we've always known. And when you look at the epithelioid type, there was also a benefit trending towards AP plus Nivo compared to chemo, hazard ratio 0.86. So these results now have positioned Ipi-Nivo as a frontline option. It is FDA approved now for mesothelioma. For sarcomatoid or non-epithelioid, this is clearly the go-to considering it's more effective than chemo. For the epithelial type, I think we now have two good options, pemetrexed platinum or Ipi-Nivo. And chances are we're going to use both of them in one sequence or the other for these patients.
So Matt, any comments on that? And also tolerability of Ipi-Nivo is always an issue. I don't know if there are any specific considerations in these patients.
I agree with Suresh's assessment, and this really is an exciting change. We've seen some second-line data in meso. This is the first really robust prospective first-line data. One point I would make, one subtle point, is when I give chemo, I usually do add bevacizumab for Bev-eligible patients, and you know, they made a compromise not to include that in this trial. So I do have equal poise between the two regimens, even in epithelioid, but I do admit I would have done carbo-pem-bev for at least half of the patients in my practice. But I think really stellar data. I tend to use immunotherapy up front now for all the patients and, again, go to carbo-pem with or without bev in the second line.
Again, any tolerability issues with mesothelioma patients? You know, I don't know if they have more pulmonary problems than a lung cancer patient. Any particularly as it relates to Ipi-Nivo issues, Matt?
No striking differences in toxicity or discontinuation rates compared to other Nivo-Ipi trials at these dose levels. So, and these are patients who are often fairly ill. So it was reassuring to see that most patients could tolerate it. And when they came off at a rate that we kind of expect already for other thoracic cancers.
So Ram, I can remember, I think it was about 10 years ago, we were going to the SNO meeting, Society of Neuro-Oncology meeting, you know, whatever, talking about glioblastoma mainly. And we started to hear about this entity, Tumor Treating Fields, which I thought was really interesting and actually is approved in GBM, but now is approved in mesothelioma. Can you talk a little bit about how this therapy works, Suresh?
Sure. This takes us back to high school physics, where we talk about electrical fields. But here, the critical issue is interfering with mitotic spindle assembly. You know, tubulin plays an important role in mitosis, and tubulin subunits line up in the cell to cause mitosis. And when you give low-dose alternating electrical currents, you're interfering with the ability of tubulin to form its proper structure that is essential for the cell to undergo division. So this disruption of tubulin formation, spindle formation, is induced by the tumor-treating field, and that is what causes mitotic RS and anti-cancer effects with this drug. So we've seen this strategy is now approved for the treatment of mesothelioma in patients with newly diagnosed disease. The approval was based on a single-arm trial with 80 patients where they received platinum-based chemo along with TTF. And the median overall survival was approximately 18 months, even more impressive for epithelial compared to sarcomatoid. This resulted in FDA approval of TTF with chemo. The side effect profile, typically is similar to what you would see with chemo alone. TTF alone causes some mild skin reaction in patients, typically grade 1 or 2 in most patients. There were no treatment-related deaths in this trial. This is approved based not on the typical benchmark we use for drug approvals. It is approved based on a device criteria. So the bar is different when you compare it to approval for anti-cancer drugs. And that's the reason why the widespread adoption of this is still slow to come. because there's no randomized phase two or phase three trials to see what is the added value of TPS.
So Matt, it's interesting. There are quite a few places, at least I think two or three places in every state, almost every many states that actually offer this. And I guess even though the toxicity seems minimal, very minimal, I mean, there's electrodes that you have to wear on your chest for 18 hours a day. In GBM, they had to wear it on their head. So, you know, it's inconvenient. And in some cases, they get skin irritation, but certainly nothing like a lot of the systemic therapies. You can see, like everything else, now they're going to look at this combined with immunotherapy. That should be super interesting. But I'm just kind of curious, Matt, you know, how this plays out. You know, a lot of times you have situations where maybe you're not going to recommend something, but you want to let patients know about it. So in case they read about it, I'm just kind of curious clinically, Matt, what your thoughts are. Have you recommended this to patients? Do you bring it up to patients? Where are you today with this, Matt?
Sure. We certainly have discussed it in our group. You know, we have our CNS group is very facile in using, again, the brain application of this. So we have the expertise in-house. When we've talked about it as a thoracic group, and that includes some of the brain radiation folks who do micrometastatic disease up there, we kind of come to the decision not to enthusiastically support it at this point. I think it's a little disingenuous for mesothelioma in 2021 that you can't do a randomized controlled trial. Mesothelioma is a very heterogeneous disease, and I just feel like you really do need to have that level of data for me to feel more enthusiastic about it. I talk about it with patients. I talk about the logistics of it. As you mentioned, 18 hours a day wearing what's kind of like a bulletproof vest kind of feel to it, but, you know, not especially obtrusive, not as visible as the brain application. But I do admit that I talk about maybe the liabilities of the data and my hope that maybe there'll be more data to emerge in the future. And my patients, at least so far, have chosen not to do it in the chemo line that I'm offering them.
Curious, Ram, what your thoughts about it. When I first heard about this, I was just like, wow, there's something different, at least. I like the idea that we're trying a different strategy. How are you approaching this clinically right now today, Suresh?
It's not something we have routinely adopted for our practice. This is part of the conversation we have with the patient with mesothelioma. But our go-to approach has still been the systemic therapy.
So just one question to the audience on mesothelioma before we move on. Curious audience, in a patient who starts out with chemo, Bev, you know, cisplatin, PEM, and Bev, and then maintenance PEM, Bev, who has progression, what's your second line therapy? I don't know, LURB is not approved, but I think there's some data coming out on it. How do you think through, a lot of people we just talked about ipi-nivo, would you use that second line? Matt, how do you think through second line? The audience says overwhelmingly ipi-nivo. A few people say pembro.
That's been my approach even before CheckMate 743 came through. We've had this hint that in the second line that a double agent does better than a single agent. Now, again, these patients sometimes are somewhat ill on presentation, especially after chemo. So there's a little bit of a patient selection of whether they're eligible for double immunotherapy. But if they are, I'm inclined to do that, whether it's first line or after a chemotherapy failure.
Suresh, again, second line?
I still look at how well they did with first line therapy. If they did really well and they had a long interval before they relapsed, I would re-challenge them with platinum doublet chemotherapy. Now with the approval of ipi-nivo, I think ipi-nivo is a very reasonable regimen to use in this setting.
So let's talk a little bit about small cell. Again, something that we hadn't seen anything new and exciting. We started to see some things the last couple of years, particularly the use of checkpoint inhibitors with chemotherapy up front. Ram, anything you want to say about, you know, we have both the study with the Caspian study with durvalumab as well as the study with atezo. Any way to separate those two out at this point? And we've been seeing continued data, including this follow-up data set in Lancet Oncology this year from the Caspian study.
Right. And the good news is we have two effective immunotherapy approaches for small cell lung cancer, chemo with durva and chemo with atezo, and they're both comparable in their effectiveness. You see a very clinically meaningful hazard ratio. The other point is we don't have biomarkers. PD-L1 expression is not very helpful in predicting who will benefit, and that was the update at AACR where they looked at TMB and PD-L1 expression levels to see if it will select out patients who do well with atezo plus chemo approach. And the answer was no, that was not very predictive. So we don't use any biomarkers at this time for routine treatment. We use them with chemo, either atezo or durva as the immunotherapy of choice.
So Matt, from your point of view, is this a complete coin flip or any way to separate out these two checkpoint inhibitors to combine with chemo?
Not especially. There were some subtle differences between the trials, including whether you had to use cisplatin or had your choice of a platinum. But I really think these are small differences that lead me to say I'll take either one. We tend to use atezo just because it was approved first, but I would have no compunction about swapping that out.
So I want to also talk about second line therapy. And we've been hearing the last year or so, lurbinectin or LURB. Can you talk a little bit, Suresh, about what actually LURB is? And is it like trabectinin? It has the last, you know, kind of similar name, so to speak.
Yes. It is a cytotoxic drug. It also has effects on transcription factors that are critical for sustenance of the cancer cell. Now, more recently, there's also some suggestion it may have effects on the immune microenvironment as well. But regardless of what the specific mechanism is, we have seen anti-cancer effects. This drug has been studied in a cohort of 100-plus patients with small cell lung cancer. Specifically, in the chemo-sensitive group, the response rate was nearly 45%. In the chemo-refractory disease, it's about 20-plus percent, which is still respectable, considering nothing works for this patient population. The median overall survival for the whole cohort was 9 months. Median PFS was about 3.5 months. When you look at the toxicity profile, it's similar to what you would expect with cytotoxic drugs, hematologic toxicities. You do see some GI effects, fatigue, transaminitis. But overall, it is now available as part of accelerated approval process as a single agent. We use 3.2 milligram per meter squared every 3 weeks. And I've started to use this drug in the past few months, and I've seen good tolerance, and my first patient seems to be doing really well.
Yeah, I guess initially people, I think, were gravitating to it because of its toxicity compared to the other second-line therapies available. Matt, have you had any experience with it and any thoughts about it? And also, we saw there's, as always, press releases come out that kind of get in our head, and this is a phase 3 study where they combined it with doxorubicin second line. I think the dose is a little bit lower, but they're saying that the trial's not positive. Any thoughts about this press release, Matt? And up to now, how have you been thinking through LURB?
Well, certainly it's something new on the horizon. Topotecan's pretty weak sauce as a standard second line therapy. I actually, my practice didn't use topotecan that often. I usually went to a taxane anyway for tolerability and what I kind of thought was pretty similar efficacy. I have only one patient I've used LURB in. Got approximately the median PFS that was seen in the initial phase 2 trial, well tolerated. But certainly that press release gives us pause. We have to always wait and see how the data come out. But a little concerning that in the bigger study and in combination with doxo, albeit at the lower dose, we're not quite seeing this robust result against, again, some pretty poor standards of care, topotecan or even CAV.
So a couple of good questions in the chat room. Ram, third line preferred therapy with extensive stage small cell, assuming IO chemo first line. So let's say LURB second line. How about third line? You're going to come back to checkpoint therapy.
Pembrolizumab does have an approval as third line, but that was based on cohort of patients who had not received prior immunotherapy. So giving Pembro or IO as monotherapy in third line, I don't think in an IO exposed patient is going to be very helpful. If the patient has not seen topotecan, I would still consider that in that setting. Some people would use taxanes, but really clinical trial is the setting where we should be steering these patients to.
So another question in the chat, Rune, Matt, it really leads into a broader question of brain mets and IO. So this person wanted to know about patients with small cell, significant CNS disease, you still use chemoimmunotherapy. I'm just kind of curious in general, Matt, about the issue of brain mets and IOs. I have heard people say, for example, a non-small cell, you know, almost like the, you know, mutation story. If they don't have any symptoms, they're going to require whole brain radiation. They have small lesions, the patient's stable. maybe give them checkpoint therapy? Do you do that? Do you see responses in the brain, Matt? And how about in
small actually cells? Sarah Goldberg out of Yale and her colleagues published this phase two trial, single center, that did ask that question kind of prospectively. If you have a tumor between 5 and 20 millimeters, can you give pembro alone and see a benefit? And they did see a decent response rate that suggests, again, in that well-selected patient that you're following really closely, you might be able to use immunotherapy in that setting. In that trial, several of the patients were second and third line, so kind of it just depends on the context, but it's provocative. And I think especially in small cell, to the physician's question, where we have so much CNS involvement, I still will give whole brain radiation up front to the bulk of these patients, especially if they have the kind of burden that the questioner was referring to. But then I am certainly happy to use chemo IO as my first line of therapy with enthusiasm. And furthermore, when I do get a benefit systemically in that stage 4 patient, even with CNS disease, our group has been doing chest consolidation after 4 cycles of chemotherapy if the patient's responding. So kind of borrowing over from Slotman, albeit in a trial that didn't include patients who had seen immunotherapy before.
Suresh, anything you want to add on to that?
No, I think if the brain met is symptomatic, we would treat the brain first. If the brain met is small, we start with systemic therapy, and I'm perfectly comfortable giving chemo IO approaches in those patients and follow the brain closely.
So as often happens, someone in the chat room asked the question that I had no information on at all, and Suresh immediately, so PARP inhibitors and lung cancer, I know nothing about that, but Suresh, you say there's a trial looking at it?
Yes, actually we did a trial at ECOG, which combined chemo with PARP inhibition, veliparib. This was pre-IO era, and that trial showed a favorable signal for the combination of PARP plus chemo. The problem is we don't have a biomarker. Now there is some suggestion that Schlafen-Levin expression could be a biomarker for PARP inhibition. So in the SWOG study, patients go through their initial chemo, and then for the maintenance phase, depending on their biomarker, they are then treated with a PARP inhibitor. That is very much an ongoing study. There are biological reasons why combining IO plus PARP inhibition could be a helpful strategy. There are studies that are ongoing to look into that. There is a trial that we had reported at ESMO last year in non-small cell lung cancer with a similar approach in a small group of patients, and that was using niraparib plus pembrolizumab that showed a favorable signal. So there's an ongoing phase 3 trial in non-small cell as well in the maintenance setting combining PARP plus immunotherapy.
Another question, Matt, from the chat room. What about the patient with paraneoplastic syndrome with the question of IO up front? So, Matt, you know, we see things like SIEDH, but we also see things like Eaton-Lambert. You have a patient with something like that, or you're still going to use an IO?
It probably depends on which paraneoplastic syndrome. I'm probably a little more concerned about something like Lambert-Eaton. I'm not familiar with data. Maybe Suresh is. Obviously, kind of a small set of a small population of a small group. But again, if the philosophy is to treat the underlying cause, which is the cancer, I'm probably still inclined to use platinum IO in the first line in the vast majority of those patients.
So another question, this strategy that we just started hearing about, like I'd say in the last year, now I see oncologists doing this all the time, which is you get a patient with metastatic non-small cell, you have your PD-L1, but you don't have your NGS. And the idea of giving the patient chemo just to temporize them if they're sick, but not giving an IO until you know the NGS. I'm seeing more and more people do that, Suresh. I guess the idea is, you don't want to get stuck giving somebody an IO and then have to use a TKI and get the synergistic toxicity. Is that sort of standard of care right now in the initial management, Suresh?
Right. Our approach is to try and wait as long as possible, if you can, to get the NGS results back. If a clinical situation is such that you cannot wait, then starting chemo alone is, as you mentioned, the right way to go. Because the IO drugs have long half-life. If once you're given one dose, it's going to be in the system for 3 months. Even if you say, I'm going to stop it and move to osimertinib, you're still exposing the patient to the combination of osimertinib and IO.
So that also leads into another question. I'd like to get both of your takes, because we've seen people go back and forth and give different answers to this, Matt. which is the use of IO in patients with targetable mutations. And, you know, you start out with EGFR, but now you got seven different approved targeted or targets, so to speak. Are we kind of approaching them all the same and delaying IO, Matt? What about the smoker who has a BRAF mutation? Do you approach them differently? IOs in targetable situations, Matt?
Well, I think it's two issues, right? There's an efficacy question and a toxicity question. The biggest toxicity question is overlap between a PD-L1 inhibitor and osimertinib. That's really the strongest compound high-grade pneumonitis risk there is. And that hasn't been seen in all such kind of interactions, but that's the one that's most worrisome. But the other thing is efficacy. So EGFR and ALK, we know the single agent activity is very poor from the docetaxel versus various PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor data. Not necessarily true of some of the emerging mutations. And again, I think we have to learn more about this over time because a lot of our older studies wouldn't have found the NTRK fusion, the MET exon 14 skip mutation. MET exon 14 skip mutation is one of my favorites because it's one that actually is more prevalent in those who have a smoking history. And so it really will be that patient who demographically doesn't look like they ought to get a targeted therapy, but who does warrant one in the first or second line. But then again, we are seeing, depends on the data set, that some of these other mutations do have favorable results, at least to chemo IO.
So Ram, people tell me, but I can't remember that at one point early on, smoking was an important clinical factor. And, you know, whether or not how people view potential benefit from IOs. And of course, we kind of move beyond that. But I'm curious how you approach patients with targetable mutations. Do you approach them all the same? You know, I think it gets into this issue. Are we going to have to do trials and gather data on every single one of these? It'll take forever. Or do you just sort of have an algorithm for all of them, Suresh?
I think we're beginning to look at real world databases to understand some of the answers to this. And hopefully we'll have clarity on that. Important to keep in mind that the chemo IO trials excluded EGFR mutated patients for a large part and ALK positive patients. So how these drugs work in these patients is still a question of ongoing investigation. So our first approach is targeted therapy when they develop acquired resistance. Chemo is the go-to. Whether adding immunotherapy to chemo is helpful or not is being studied in the EGFR, KEYNOTE-789 trial. We should see the results in the upcoming year or so. So until then, chemo alone remains the standard for those patients.
So Ram and Matt, thank you so much for sharing your experience and knowledge with us today.